It often seems to me as though I am looking at a landscape painting, but most of it's covered still. And there are certain areas, you know, a corner here and a tree there and a little rock over here, and I can kind of see those pieces, but the whole landscape, I still don't feel like I'm seeing.
I'm Michael Max, and this is Geological. Our work is often like threading a needle. There's this sweet spot of not too much and not too little, a kind of Goldilocks zone of exactly what's right, like the soft potency of a well-timed whisper. Our work is to coax order out of chaos in a way that brings forth more coherence and more vitality. The work is as much about being as it is about doing. It's about listening as much as it is acting, helping those parts that have been displaced or dispossessed to find a kind of agency and bring themselves forth. I've found over time that the body responds best to a clear message, simple and direct. And for this to occur, it's essential to have a clear sense of where the problem is and what the problem is. Without these, our treatments easily can go wide of the mark. A clear diagnosis, or as I like to think of it these days, a viable working hypothesis, it gives us a powerful lever in helping our patients move into a state of fuller function and harmony. Of course, the past has its influence. We all traveled the road we have to arrive in this present moment. The conditions and circumstances of the present are the grindstone of where heaven and earth come together and allow us humans to use our jing and shun to work with the pressures, conflicts, and contradictions of opposites in such a way that we can generate a broader, wider, and more inclusive spectrum of being. Healing work is the work of bringing forth the agency in our patients that allows them more fully to live in the tensions and discomforts of joining heaven and earth. This idea of joining heaven and earth, you know, it sounds lovely and harmonious, but the truth is, it requires grit and persistence, along with a willingness to let ourselves be transformed into something that we might not even recognize. For healing to occur, there needs to be a certain amount of stability, enough of a sense of security in the ground upon which we stand, that we can allow ourselves to become undone. You need the right amount of yin and wei, the right mix of nutritive and protective, and more importantly, the vitality that arises from the interdependence between them. One of my teachers once told me that the way humans best grow and develop is to have both support and challenge. It's within that crucible that transformative change can occur. I noodle these days on these questions. Are we here to fix or facilitate? Are we here to remove a person's suffering or help them find within themselves the ability to bootstrap their own transformation? Are we here to comfort or to compel? Are we here to help them erase the effects of their history or use that experience painfully gained to create a more embodied future, to bring forth the conditions that allow them to live fully between the grindstones of heaven and earth? A few weeks ago, in episode 145, we talked with two researchers, Lisa Taylor Swanson and Lisa Conboy, about a research project that they were instrumental in designing and looking at how Chinese herbal medicine is used in response to the symptoms of COVID-19. This week, we speak with some of the practitioners who are doing the clinical arm of that research project, how they're doing the work, and what they're learning about our medicine, and also what they're learning about COVID-19 as they do this work. But before that, I've got a couple messages of interest for you. First, the Shennong Society has created a pandemic case study tool. Western medicine has a template for collecting cases, and so does acupuncture, but East Asian herbal medicine does not. Shennong hopes that their tool will serve as groundwork in the development of sharing clinical cases. In addition, there are several studies being done that focused on East Asian medicine. Shennong Society has worked with both the Seattle Institute of East Asian Medicine and the National University of Natural Medicine in the development of their template, so there would be these crosswalks between all the studies, which will help with examining cases and better understanding of how our medicine is helpful against COVID-19. Go to shennongsociety.org to add your case. For all you thought leaders out there in our medicine, I invite you to set aside diagnostic questioning for a moment and turn your attention to precision inquiry coupled with embodied presence. Body-friendly language begins with curiosity and attention to your own body. Learn more with our Communicating with Qi series beginning in July. For details and early bird savings through the end of the month, text powerful words, all one word, to the number 33777. You know, it seems deceptively simple at first. A few basic principles, hot, cold, wet, dry, up, down, in, out, excess, deficient. Simple principles, easily grasped, but endlessly applicable through a wide spectrum of clinical experience. So Om Acupuncture takes these basic principles and allows you to understand and treat a wide variety of clinical issues using the Qi transformation of the five phases, the diagnostic parameters of the six conformations, and the ever-unfolding balance of yin and yang. Here's a quick clinic tip that's germane to this moment in time. For those who are angry, frustrated, spending time and energy putting their energy outwards, and at the same time feel like they can't settle into themselves or grab a quiet, nourishing breath or sleep well, then using the four needles of liver 1 and pericardium 9 going with the channel, kidney 10 and pericardium 3 going against the channel, put them all on the same side, it makes a profound difference. You'll learn why this treatment is helpful and a lot more in our Intro to Sa'am class with Toby Daly. That's July 11 and 12. Details over on the website. And here's a message from Real Mushrooms, the sponsor of this episode, on one of my favorite medicinals, cordyceps.
Hi, I'm Sky Chilton here from Real Mushrooms. I'm curious, how well do you know your cordyceps, or dongshang xiaxiao, the caterpillar fungus? This is now the most expensive mushroom in the world. Given the hefty price tag, it rarely makes it into today's supplements. I'll be back to tell you more about the different forms of cordyceps. If you'd like to provide a potent cordyceps for your patients, text Real Mushrooms, all one word, to 33777. Real Mushrooms, pure, simple, and effective.
You know, sometimes it's daunting when you think about all the different methods that we have within Chinese medicine and all the different perspectives that can be brought to bear on any particular situation. It can be even more daunting to realize that we need not just one lineage, but many in times that are really difficult. Let's get into this conversation on how the folks over at the Seattle Institute of East Asian Medicine are using the various herbal medicine traditions in the treatment of symptoms of COVID-19. Hey friends, I have a follow-up conversation here. We spoke a few weeks ago with Lisa Conboy and Lisa Taylor Swanson about a study that they are instrumental in designing on studying the use of Chinese medicine, or Chinese herbal medicine in particular, in the treatment of COVID-19 type symptoms. And today I have Craig Mitchell, the president of the Seattle Institute of East Asian Medicine, Kathy Tiramino, who, what do you do? I think you actually run this school, don't you?
She's the dean.
She's the dean. All right. That's what I said. She runs the school. And Dan Bensky, who is an author and publisher of a couple of herb books. Y'all might have read them at one point or another. And what we're here today to discuss is sort of the practical arm of this research study, how the research is being carried out. And then, because we're all practitioners, I know for myself, and I suspect for you listeners, we're really curious to know what these practitioners are seeing in terms of symptoms, how they're responding to herbs. Of course, this is all done through the study, but you know, you can't do treatment and not start to pick up some ideas about what's going on with something even before research results come out. So I thank all of you for being here today. And Kathy, could you tell us a bit about how this research is being carried out, what you guys are doing?
Well, what we're doing is we're running what we call an observational study. So we're basically looking at and capturing data on our usual practice. So we're not doing anything unique for patients who enroll in the study than we would do with patients who are not enrolled in the study. So what we're trying to do, a big goal of the whole project is to sort of, you know, capture, document, analyze the practice of Chinese herbal medicine in this setting with patients, you know, with COVID-type symptoms in the way it would normally be practiced. So we're not doing what we call an interventional trial. The clinicians are doing everything that they would do just as they would in normal care, which is something that we're really excited about. So we're not sort of changing things or changing how patients are treated based on the fact that they're enrolled in the study. So it is really a reflection of actual practice.
It sounds to me like you guys are studying Chinese medicine on Chinese medicine's terms.
That was the goal.
It makes my heart so happy to hear that.
It was difficult to put together.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit? I mean, we had that conversation. If y'all haven't listened to it, it was about a month ago on how it was designed. But I'm curious from your side to hear about how it was put together. How did you guys come up with this idea?
Well, the idea came from the school when we started to open the clinic and start to help patients in these situations. We also sort of had this sister idea of, well, why don't we capture it and do something with it and help? And the whole goal was basically to help others treat their patients. That was really singularly the entire goal of the idea, was how do we figure out a mechanism to share our experience so that it might help others help their patients. And that sort of escalated into what we're doing now, which is a full study, capturing the whole picture.
It's amazing sometimes when an idea, it's the right time for it, things really can fall into place pretty quickly. Craig, can you tell us a bit about how this is being carried out at the school?
So I will do that. And before I do that, however, I have to, Kathy is a little bit shy about taking credit where it's due. And it is in no small part, the fact that we're doing this is because Kathy came up with this idea. I mean, she and I talked about the possibility of us running a clinic and all of that. Like this was very much collaborative at that stage. And then, but then out of that, she really came up with this idea of, oh, we could actually do this as a research study. And she is really the one who is the brains behind the study. It's not to say that she hasn't had help, and that Lisa Conboy and Lisa Taylor Swanson and Lee Hollander Rubin, immensely, immensely helpful, but it really came out of Kathy's initiative. So I just want to give some credit there because I think that's important. In terms of the way that it's actually running, you know, we're fortunate, Michael, as you know, that we have some very, very experienced practitioners that we have access to in the Seattle area. I mean, in a sense, because this is telemedicine, the practitioners could be anywhere. But for our purposes, as a starting point, when Kathy and I were talking about, well, who are going to be the herbalists that are participating in this study at the beginning, we just thought about our immediate community and thought, well, we need to have people who have, say, 15 plus years of experience prescribing Chinese herbal medicine. One, because of the complexity of the cases that we would be seeing. And two, because if you don't have a lot of experience writing Chinese herbs in an in-person setting, and then you're asked to do this in a telemedicine setting, we thought that that would be overwhelming for a newer practitioner. So we reached out to Dan Bensky, who everyone knows, but who's also one of the founders of our school. And Dan and I had already, I think at that point, we may have already seen some patients together at that point. And so Dan and I talked that through a little bit and thought, well, Dan was interested in participating. We have Shochun Ma, who is a practitioner originally from Chongqing, but who lives in Seattle now, who has been seeing patients for somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 years. We have Daniel Altschuler, who is one of our faculty, who has, I'm not sure, maybe 20, 30 year range of experience. Myself, I have about 25 years of experience. Christina Jackson, who's another faculty member, who's about 15 to 20 years of experience. So we really pulled on the people in our community who have a significant long-term history of using herbs. And we do the telehealth visits about a half hour, 45 minutes. Practitioner is there, the patient is there. The practitioner goes through whatever questions they have for the patient. We either get a picture of the tongue or take a look at it over Zoom, which is actually very challenging, I have to say. And we try to run the clinic as much as we can like a quote unquote normal patient visit.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, other than pulse, there's a lot that you can do over a televisit.
It's difficult because, you know, for myself, I rely heavily on an abdominal exam. Dan relies heavily on other palpatory things that he does, the engaging vitality stuff. And so it's been a real challenge for us, I would say, to do it in this medium.
Yeah. Well, I remember when I was first studying, it seemed like the herbal medicine piece of it was very much tongue, pulse, symptom picture. As I learned acupuncture, there was all this palpatory stuff that we were exposed to, you know, and I get it over time, everything kind of blends together. But in some ways, this is really an opportunity to do like herbal medicine just as quote herbal medicine. Although maybe, especially for you guys, it's like you got one arm tied behind your back.
Maybe two.
So I'm curious to know about what kinds of symptoms you're seeing. What does this look like from our Chinese medicine point of view? I know that I spoke, I think it was in February with Jin Zhao in Chengdu, and he was talking about how they were really seeing a lot of very heavy, gooey, damp kinds of presentations. And they were really looking at getting rid of dampness. There was some cold, but damp was like the great big thing. I'm wondering, this is a different season, it's a different place. What kinds of things are you guys seeing in the clinic?
Well, I think there's two aspects to what we've seen. And that's, remember, our patients are actually all over the place, mostly in the United States, but maybe not, I don't know, maybe you guys know exactly, 20, 30% of them are not in the Seattle area. We have people on the East Coast, people in the Midwest. And so I think, to me, I've learned a couple things. And I think it has to do with the tension or the synthesis in Chinese medicine between Bianzheng and Bianbing, between differentiating the pattern and differentiating the disease. And as I'm sure you know, Michael, there's a lot of discussion in our profession by people who I would consider ideologues, that this must be either a Shanghan problem or it must be a Wenbing problem or something else like that. And our experience with COVID positive patients is very clear that that's a nonsensical way to approach this problem. I think maybe in one of our clinics, again, and one of the great things about our clinics, I think there's two great things. One is usually there's two of us, and also the whole school is involved. There's like 20, 30 people listening, so they can see, as I like to say, how the sausage is made. And we had one patient, oh yeah, I'm COVID positive. First thing that happened, I felt really chilled, and I had a headache, and the back of my upper back was really tight, and I was achy all over. And then the next person, oh yeah, the first thing happened, I had a really bad sore throat and a high fever, and I was sweating like mad. So, you know, we had people who basically, COVID positive patients who read their symptoms out of the Shanghan Lun, read it out of the Wenbing Taobian, read it out of the Shi Yi Lun. So we have seen from a Bianzheng perspective that it's all over the map. Like whatever the different approaches that have been developed in East Asia to deal with infectious diseases, they can all apply. Now, again, these people are in different places. So it's possible in one place, it's, we don't have the numbers, but it's possible that in one place it's more Shanghan and another place is more Wenbing. But I don't think we have any evidence of that. So there's that aspect. That's, I would say, crystal clear that for better or for worse, you want to understand what's going on with these patients. You have to differentiate the pattern. It's not like we can just all take, oh, you have COVID here. You have early stage COVID, take these herbs, which maybe would be nice, but that's not the way it is. On the other hand, there may be something that, again, it's hard for us to tell, but there is some sense that there is, for the majority of patients, definitely not for all patients, there is something that's a little different that ties things together. That there is this dampness or pathogenic water or some kind of fluid disorder that, again, we would normally depend on our palpatory skills or the pulse to be clear, because oftentimes when they have pathological dampness, the tongue can be dry. The tongue doesn't really help you as much as we would like. So there's that aspect. There is the phenomena, which I think is very common, of people getting better and then kind of overdoing things and then getting worse again, sometimes for long periods of time. So this is whole spectrum. Again, not only spectrum in terms of bianzheng, what kind of problems they can have, but in the severity, you know, we know lots of people have COVID that's like at worst a mild cold, and many other people pass away, die from it. So there is that. We are trying to figure out what this is. We have a clue that maybe there's also some blood stasis involved. Again, very difficult for us to tell through telemedicine, but I think in some of our patients, and Craig will correct me if I'm wrong, that when we started doing things about this little extra phlegm aspect or a little extra blood stasis aspect, that we were able to get better results than we had previously. So that's completely, not speculative, but that's a very tentative initial impression. So I think that's the main things that we've learned, that it's very clear that it's not one of the different approaches that we've learned. It can be all the different approaches that we've learned. And again, which is either the feature or the bug of East Asian medicine, you have to be flexible and you have to not put your ego into whatever your diagnosis is, which has its good points and bad points. But that there's also something else that's a little different. And part of it is, all the patients we see are mild to moderate. We've never seen anyone in the hospital. And I think only one or two of our patients have ended up hospitalized. Is that right, Craig? So that's one segment that we've talked about. But I have an osteopathic buddy who's does osteopathy in a hospital in the Bronx for the last 30 years. And so he saw lots and lots of COVID patients who were hospitalized, and they had very unusual findings. And again, as background, he's been a hospital-based person who does osteopathy for about 30 years. And there's many of the patients he's seen has stuff he's never seen before. And part of it is that their fluids and their connective tissue are really, really disturbed. I think maybe we could translate this into East Asian medicine terms, but normally when you look at different kinds of tissues in the body, they have the sense of being made out of water, which is what they are, right? And sometimes, again, we can use this in our other stuff, it's more like they're made out of salad oil or cream, or really, really bad would be molasses. That he said that, again, this is about 80 patients who've been hospitalized, their fluids felt like they were made out of tar, which is something that all of these patients had that he has never, ever felt before. So in people who have severe COVID disorders, there is something else going on. Again, that's not based on our personal experience because we don't see those patients. But I think even in the mild or moderate people, the stuff that's hanging on, that is, again, through telemedicine, not readily apparent to us, we have tentatively thought, oh, maybe there's some phlegm blood stasis aspects going in. And we have some very preliminary impressions that approaching it in that way from an herbal perspective can be helpful. Do you agree, Craig?
Definitely. And I just wanted to add one just little anecdotal thing. There was one afternoon that we were seeing patients, Michael, and Dan and I were working together. And I think we saw four patients, all who had either positive COVID test or COVID symptoms. And each one of them, like literally, like the first one was a Shanghan Lun case. The second one was a Wenbing case. The third one was a damp phlegm toxin case. And the fourth one was some other like random thing that didn't really fit in any of those categories. And we just, you know, we were talking about it that day because it was so striking to us. And I think particularly in the context of these arguments that are going on in, you know, in social media and whatnot about whether this is really Shanghan or really Wenbing or really whatever, it just, we were just laughing mm-hmm. about that, honestly, because this is just one afternoon of clinic where we saw at least four different kinds of presentations.
And they weren't subtle. I mean, it really was like, oh, first person, I'm going to read to you. I'm going to tell you about myself by reading out line one of the Shanghan Lun. Right. The next person, I have the second chapter of the Wenbing Kelbian. I think I'll tell you about myself.
So is it this? Yes, it's all of this.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And again, there may be climactic, there may be genetic. Now, again, it could be that if you were in one area, you might see one of those things. That's perfectly plausible, but that's not going to help us understand the disease better or how, in general, I guess you have to approach it like you approach almost everything else in our medicine.
Well, like you say, is that the feature or the bug? It's the thing about Chinese medicine for me that makes it phenomenally interesting. I am just never, ever bored with it. The downside, you know, the opposite side of that is more than one lifetime, you know, to get, you know, any one perspective down really. It's a big job doing this, and to be able to have enough familiarity and a certain amount of fluency with any of the different traditions so that you know, like, oh, here's a situation, this will be helpful. Here's a situation, actually, that previous patient I saw, that would be the wrong thing for them.
And also, I think this is the brilliance of Kathy's way of doing this particular study is we live in an industrial or post-industrial society. We think about our medical system. It's all based on a factory model. And this has been true for the last 120 years in Chinese medical history. Our medicine is not industrial type of medicine. You can't really put us in that box. And this is, again, for nation states, this is a disadvantage to the medicine because you require trained people who are flexible, et cetera, to do a decent job. You can't just put out, okay, everybody has this thing comes back, you give them that, they'll be fine, which is the way that our society works and that whole healthcare system works. So I don't know. I mean, you know, Kathy always gives people offers they can't refuse. So she must have done the same thing with this study, is how she got to approve even an observational study that's, for better or for worse, it's real. There's no doubt about it. Given the circumstance, it's as real as you can get. That's really exciting and interesting. But I think it shows that is such a problem because we don't really practice an industrial form of medicine.
Well, one of the things I appreciate about what you're doing with this and the way the study is being conducted is that you're studying Chinese medicine on Chinese medicine's terms. And you're actually having people come in that this study can capture that information. If you were just doing a protocolized thing, which is, of course, very popular and industrial, you'd miss so much stuff. It's really a chance for us to see what the medicine does when it's being practiced as the medicine that it is. Dan, I'm very appreciative of your comments about your colleague in the hospitals in the Bronx, an old school osteopath who knows how to use their hands to understand things And he says there's something going on with fluids. For me, I take that as a cross confirmation with what I'm hearing and seeing from the Chinese medicine world, which says something here with fluids.
Even the mainstream biomedical world, something's here with fluids, right? This is no matter how, that's the disease. That's what's going on. Regardless of your perspective, it's clear.
It's clear if you know how to look at it. Right. Again, if you're looking, oh, we've got this this deadly pathogen, and it's a pneumonia, right? Or it's a flu-like thing. It can be a red herring to think that way. I mean, the beauty of Chinese medicine, it gives us these other perspectives to look at it through.
Well, I think though the issues they've been having with ventilation and ventilators with these patients, that's also a recognition there's some fluid disorder going on. And the way that we normally would know that those very skilled and very caring people, what they normally do isn't working. And that's more upsetting to them than we can imagine. It's incredibly upsetting. But it's the same thing. Oh, there's some kind of fluid aspect that's going on. And, they don't know what to do about it. They're working on it. But I think anybody who has open mind about what they're doing sees that this COVID, whatever SARS-CoV-2 virus messes with people's fluids. So I think whether it's from osteopathic perspective, biomedical perspective, East Asian medical perspective, if you actually see the patients, even if you see them through a screen, it's clear.
You were talking about there might be issues with the blood as well. I'm curious to know what you guys are seeing with that.
Again, this is one of those things that's really difficult for us. I think this is, I would say, actually, I'll let Craig finish it, but this is really clear where we have two hands tied behind our back, because it's almost more that Yiling Gai Cuo thing about, well, things don't respond the way you think they should, even though you see no signs of blood stasis, you approach it like blood stasis. It won't show up in the tongue very often. We can't feel the pulse or can't feel their fluids. But I think it's just why is this nagging? Why do they have this kind of, rebound issue? And so, again, very tentatively, when we started adding those kinds of herbs, we seem to get slightly better results. You can probably elaborate, Craig.
Well, I think one of the things that's been so frustrating to us and to patients is we've had, especially early on, we had a few patients who seemed like they were doing great. And then they, I was feeling really good and I went out for a long walk. Not even, like I went out and ran or something. Just I went for a longer than normal walk. And the next day I was wiped out again. My fever went back up and I started to feel poorly again. And so the recovery process seems so maddeningly difficult. And I think part of the way that we've begun to understand that is through these two kind of lenses, intersecting lenses, one being the phlegm, damp, fluid congestion side, and the other being the blood stasis side. And I think in some cases, we have made the decision to treat one or both of those things on just the slimmest little sliver of, oh, we saw a little bit of, sublingual vein distension or something, or there's just a little bit of darkness on the tongue. And we just sort of immediately go, okay, we're going to treat blood stasis at least a little bit in this patient. And while that does seem helpful, and I think it's leading us in the right direction, I would still say that continues to be, a work in progress, because it's not like, we are not at the point where we're routinely just, oh, patient comes in, they're super sick with COVID symptoms. Oh, and we get them better like that. That's not the case. And I mean, the one thing, just a little anecdote that I wanted to throw out about the issues with ventilators. We did have a patient early on that we worked with who ended up on a ventilator briefly. And one of the, working hypotheses, at least for me, and I think for Kathy, because we talked about this a bit, is that part of the reason why he went on the ventilator and came back off again relatively quickly and is doing, knock wood, relatively fine now, is that he got a bunch of treatment before he needed to be hospitalized. And so his internal environment was different than it would have been otherwise going into that. So it's still, there's so many, it often seems to me as though I am looking at a landscape painting, but most of it's covered still. And there are certain areas, you know, a corner here and a tree there and a little rock over here. And I can kind of see those pieces, but the whole landscape, I still don't feel like I'm seeing.
It seems like that's the case throughout the world with people approaching this thing. The level of uncertainty of just what the heck is this thing? It just seems to go through so many streams.
And now we're getting, our clinic has been, you know, expanding it, its patient base, treating just people who are coming in for the sequela. Patients we didn't see during the illness who are reaching out to be seen for what is being described here.
Mm-hmm. What other kinds of sequela are you seeing? I mean, often when I think of sequela, you know, I go to my Shanghan Lin thinking and I go, well, let's check for some Chaihu patterns and see, you know, there's some back and forth. Do we need to adjust the qi mechanism a bit? What kind of things are you seeing?
Again, and I'll start and maybe someone else can jump in. We just saw a patient last night, who has been sick for about a month and really up and down. He does not appear at this stage to be in any imminent danger, but he still is having, you know, top half of his body is all hot and the lower half of his body is all cold. He's night sweating. He is incredibly fatigued. He breaks a sweat, you know, with even just a tiny bit of exertion. His appetite is all out of whack. His GI system is still not right. Those are some examples of things that we've seen. I mean, he happens to have a bunch of them, but we've seen each of those kinds of things in multiple different patients.
Yeah, because we've seen quite a few patients who develop they're a little bit of a smaller or more minor version of their original presentation. Right, they come in and they go for that long walk and they get the sore throat back that they had in the beginning. And
mm-hmm. Or if they were the cold type, the back of their neck, and then they got the body aches, that kind of thing comes back.
On the more serious side, in terms of the severity of symptoms, we have also seen a few patients who have had relatively significant heart issues that appear to be linked to COVID infection.
Now, did they have these heart issues prior to being infected?
No.
No. And what kind of heart issues are you seeing?
Well, I guess and please, Dan or Kathy, jump in. I think on the mild side, palpitations and some irregularity in heartbeat. On the more severe side, significant problems with heart rhythm and rate, both, and chest pain, the whole gamut.
I mean, this sounds like that heat falling into the pericardium kind of presentation.
Yeah, it seems for this couple people I'm thinking of, it's more like, again, phlegm and blood stasis affecting the diaphragm. And the diaphragm issue seems to be, and then, you know, from a biomedical perspective, sometimes those people have electrical issues in the heart, in the anatomical heart, but it's not clear. It's a morpho. It's just kind of an idea. Not only is not clear for us, some of these people go see very, very skillful cardiologists, and the cardiologists are kind of baffled. Like, well, we haven't seen this before. We're not sure what this is. So the mystery is, I think for worse, cuts across all the different kinds of medicine.
Are there any kind of like constitutional aspects that you see with people? Certain people are going to present in a certain way, or is it just all over the map?
I don't think we have a basis for that, to make it, have an opinion one way or the other. We've seen people all different body sizes, different ethnic backgrounds, and the number, we just don't have the numbers, I think, to, for me anyway, to make any. And again, it's certainly the person's pre-existing health status appears to have no relationship to whether they have this kind of long tail problem or not. So we certainly have people with who are very fit and quite healthy who get knocked out. And then, you know, when the acute phase is over, they still have problems for weeks afterwards. So who are not obese or, you know, any, don't have diabetes, don't have those pre-existing conditions. So we've seen that. But I don't think we have anything positive to say in that, oh, this kind of person is at more at risk than that kind of person. Is that right, Kathy? So yeah, we don't seem to think from our, you know, limited experience, that's unclear. Again, these are almost all non-hospitalized COVID people, but most of them, I would say, you know, are much worse than a cold. So they would be, you probably have mild, moderate, and severe. These are maybe, you know, in between mild and moderate, most of our patients.
I often tend to think that there's a pattern to things, that things kind of run in a way that I expect them to. And then I'm used to, oh, this kind of person, they get this kind of a problem, and then it's going to go like this or it's going to go like that. I mean, I think our medicine is helpful in making prognoses based on what we're seeing. It sounds like with this thing, that kind of goes out the window.
Well, at least interacting with people with telemedicine, it goes out the window.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
It does go, yeah, we have no idea. So certainly, I think I would suggest for everybody who sees these patients, you need to keep in contact with them. You would not say, oh, take these and I'll talk to you in like 3 weeks. Like, you know, when people have, even sometimes if they've missed an appointment because they felt they were doing better, that has been a bad thing for them. So I think one thing, again, you know me, Mike, most people don't know, I don't like to see people very often. But I think for these patients, it's important to at least, you know, even if they're not acutely ill, for a few weeks after they've been sick, I think it'd be important to at least check in with them at least once a week. Do you agree, Craig and Kathy?
Yeah, I was wondering, Kathy, can you maybe talk a little bit about the setup of the, because we kind of addressed this in terms of the study design.
Well, in anticipation of that, we set up the study that it is built in that, well, actually, I mean, this is, again, for any patient who has these symptoms, that they get seen. And then once they start the herbal formula, we check in with them 24 hours later, and then again, 48 hours later. And then we decide at that point what the next step is. And we did that really early on, not really knowing if that was a really good plan that would be reflective of what we would normally do. And I think in every single case, it would have been what we would do anyway. So it has worked very, very well. And it seems to have been a good plan. We have found that in 24, particularly maybe the 48 hour mark, things change. And sometimes patients need to be seen a lot sooner than you might normally do in normal practice. That's been an important component.
Cordyceps is all the rage right now. It's included in adaptogenic formulas, workout supplements, and is one of the top superfoods. For centuries, the Chinese have used this mushroom to strengthen the lungs, kidneys, and improve vitality. Given the high price tag of wild Cordyceps sinensis, what is often sold is a pure mycelium form called CS4. So which Cordyceps does Real Mushrooms use? Hi, I'm Sky Chilton, and I'd like you to meet Cordyceps militaris. Militaris has similar benefits to the wild sinensis and is even richer in the powerful antioxidant cordycepin. What's more, it's sustainable and organically cultivated. If you'd like to provide a potent cordyceps for your patients, text Real Mushrooms, all one word, to 33777. Real Mushrooms, pure, simple, and effective.
Well, it seems like with something like COVID, you would certainly want to stay on top of it. And I remember from my schooling, we were always told that for external conditions like this, for some pathogen that comes in from the outside, it can change very quickly. And you need to keep on top of it. Sometimes it moves slowly, but sometimes it moves quickly, like so quickly that if you think a patient needs it, they should take their herbs now at your clinic. Because by the time they get home, they might be in a different place.
Just for my own, because I engage a lot in those follow-up calls, I would say I can't offhand think of a patient that didn't have a significant change in some direction within 24 to 48 hours of starting the herbal formula.
I want to talk about something positive. I know that will make everybody flip over. But
I'm glad I was sitting down.
Good. Yeah. You know, this idea that people do East Asian medicine should be prepared for some kind of pandemic has been really common for a few decades. And I'm sure probably true for Craig. Certainly one reason I got into teaching the Shanghan Lun in the 90s is that we should get ready, whether for this kind of thing or maybe the end of the antibiotic era. And we've, I think, failed fairly miserably in being prepared, to be honest. And one of the reasons is, I think up until now, it would not be uncommon for someone to come to see us and then call us and say, I can't come in today because I have the flu. And, you know, I would say for most people, certainly for myself, again, right or wrong, I thought, well, the hassle of them coming to my office, sick with the flu, is probably not worth their while. And so while in the 70s, 80s, I had a lot of experience treating acute infectious disease. I haven't for the last 30 years. And I realized, well, with this telemedicine thing, we can say, okay, well, you don't come in. Let's, go on some kind of platform and tell me what's going on. And let me look at your tongue and I'll send you some herbs and you can start taking the herbs, either mail them to you or have someone pick them up. That this is a very viable way to both help our patients because, now COVID is very problematic, but, common colds, most kinds of flu, we all know herbal medicine can work incredibly quickly. And so now I think we have learned that, let's do that next time they can't, it's too much trouble to come to your office. Both the patients should be able to get quite significant relief, at the very least get better much more quickly. And then also we get experience in treating people. And so I think that is a silver lining to me of this telemedicine in this pandemic, that we now have a pretty tried and true mechanism for seeing people with acute infectious diseases with herbs through at a distance. And I think over the next, 10, 15 years, that will change the way that we practice in this country and in the West in general to the benefit of our patients and also to our profession.
The thing about people not coming in when they're sick with a cold or a flu, I know that I've had lots of people not come in to see me as well when they're coming down with something because they're used to going to their conventional medicine practitioners who say, if you're sick, don't come in. And so often they'll go, well, I'm sick. I shouldn't come in. And so we don't get as much of a chance to actually practice with treating infectious disease. We're starting to get it now. Any other thoughts that you guys have on how we can begin to take that experience and really learn from it? I mean, I know we've got the Wenbing and the Shanghan Lun, and we've got, there's plenty of books and there's plenty of points of view, as we've already discussed. Being able to be somewhat conversant with all them would be useful. At least with COVID.
It's not that hard.
It's not that hard.
No, it's not. Not that complicated. Right? I mean, there's good books in English on all of them. Again, if you're not an ideologue, then it's not that, again, we just talk about the person who had, I had, very bad chills and I had neck pain and I was shivering and I couldn't sweat, versus though I have a sore throat and, you know, I'm sweating a lot and I have a fever and I'm just a little, you know, averse to drafts. I mean, again, those are maybe more not typical, but they occur. It's, I mean, there's lots of nuance, but the basic idea, it's not like thousands of hours of training to learn this stuff. It's probably tens of hours. And, you know, you're a medical professional. It's not, again, I don't want to say it's, I want to be clear. It's not like, oh, it's really easy to do, but to get the basic foundations to be, you know, vaguely competent, it's not that hard. It's not esoteric. You don't have to retreat to a mountainside or meditate for 10 hours a day. You just have to be open and read some things and see the patients, right? I mean, that's not, as we say, it's not Taoist rocket science. It's just, you know.
So let me, I have a couple of thoughts on this. The first is on our website. So shameless self-promotion, SIEAM.edu. You will, starting relatively soon, you will be able to see some content about what it is that we're learning from the study. So probably early on, it will be, and Kathy, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think probably early on, it will be some cases, little case reports about a few of the patients who we have been seeing and some of the results of what they were given and how they fared. So if you're interested in starting, like one of the really, I think, very elegant and thoughtful aspects of this study design was that this is not, like Kathy said to me very early on, this is not the kind of study where, oh, 3 years from now, we'll publish a paper about it. This was designed from the very beginning to be information sharing all along through the study. This is going to be open access. It's going to be free for everyone to look at and read. I mean, there will hopefully be papers that come out 3 years from now, but right now we're just trying to get information out into the community about treating these patients. So that will be coming soon-ish. The other thing is, you know, I want to both second what Dan said and also recognize that, you know, sometimes I think that, you know, we've been practicing for a long time. And I think for Dan and myself, and definitely for Kathy, like we're not wedded to one particular system. And we're interested in serving our patients as effectively as we can, regardless of what tradition the formula comes from that we use to treat them. That distinction has never been something that any of us were interested in. So if we get great results with a warm disease school formula, then that's great because the patient gets better and that's all we care about. So I do concur that there are excellent textbooks in all of these areas. You know, if in your school training you didn't get great exposure to warm disease theory or Shanghan Lun, pick up a book. Absolutely. There are great English language materials out there now in all of these domains. And they're more or less approachable, but I think starting with looking at that material and then reaching out to people maybe in your own community, or reach out to us at the school, and we can also be a resource for people who are trying to learn more about these materials. Because I do think that having a thoughtful, flexible approach that draws on the whole range of treatment strategies that are part of this amazing tradition that we're all a part of, makes all the difference to our patients in terms of our ability to be effective.
Dan, I really appreciate your sentiment on, well, there's books out there and it's not Taoist rocket surgery. It's a slice of our medicine. It's not the entirety of our medicine. It's a slice of it. So I've learned a little bit of Chinese over the years. It's not that good, but it's doable. And the reason that it's doable is because to do medical Chinese is a way smaller lift than doing all of Chinese. Learning medical Chinese, it's totally in anyone's wheelhouse if they want to do it, because the language and the vocabulary is limited. The grammar patterns are limited. It's one small piece of the larger language. And if I'm hearing you correctly, that if you want to learn to treat infectious disease, it's a piece of the medicine and it's graspable because we already have all kinds of other pieces of the medicine. So it's a matter of focusing in on this particular part. And right now we've got all kinds of opportunity for that.
Right. And again, I want to be clear. I mean, learning it is definitely doable. Doing it really well, like anything, takes practice and everything. You know, like, you know, we have a thing. If you have someone comes in with a cold and you get the herbs right, the next day they should not have a cold. If you give them 6 days of herbs and after 6 days they're better, well, that probably wasn't the most optimal treatment for them. And that happened. It happens to me. So I don't want to make it seem, oh yeah, once you learn it, it's just like that. But to learn the basics, to be able to engage with these patients in a way that should be helpful to them is not outside the ken of what you should know if you're doing Chinese herbal medicine. And again, I think you've had people on about this. Up until whatever, the 1930s, maybe 1940s, if you were a Chinese herbalist and you couldn't treat acute infectious diseases, you were bankrupt. You didn't have a practice, right? It's not, and again, that's like the 20th century. That's not like the Han Dynasty. And again, most of those people, if you read what they did in the early 20th century, they exactly what we're talking about. Some of them did more Shanghan, but they didn't only do Shanghan. Because if they didn't get their patients well quickly, they couldn't hide behind the fact, like, well, I do Shanghan, what do you expect? It'd be like, oh, but you didn't help me. Like, screw you. It's just part of the medicine. Then, you know, with the success of antibiotics and all that stuff, it's become less important. And again, as we mentioned before, with the industrialization of society, mm-hmm. ERs don't work with Chinese medicine. You can't have, you know, the pots of futsasinitang or something, you know, boiling in the background. You know, you don't have stat. This is not the way the medicine works. They've done some things for this in mainland China. But I was in Chongqing in 85 when I met Ma Laoshi, and they had a nationwide meeting about Chinese medicine and emergency medicine. What part should Chinese medicine play in emergency departments? It was in Chongqing at the same time. I had a chance to talk to some of the people. And their basic thing was, well, it works really well for these conditions, but not in, you know, what's the logistics of setting up? It's not industrial. We're just going to like pull what we want. We have to make a differentiation. We have to cook up the herbs. And in the meantime, by the time the herbs are ready, biomedicine could have treated the person already, right? So there may have been other things going on, but there was like a meeting. What is going to happen with Chinese medicine in emergencies? And the answer was, can't use it. But not because it didn't work, but because it didn't work in a way that fit to the best way to run the emergency room. That makes sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. And so it brings up for me this question, which is, we've been seeing this as an acute illness. There's a lot of talk about vaccines. Okay, good luck with that. It seems to me, and I'm not an immunologist, I'm not a virologist, but it seems to me that human beings tend to co-evolve with things. So, you know, is COVID going away? Maybe it's something we learn to live with and work with. It becomes like a chronic thing that kind of comes around from time to time. Is there a mass-produced factory-type solution to that? Maybe. But if there's not, then it seems to me the kind of stuff that Chinese medicine has to offer in terms of being able to work with each person as an individual as they are in any particular moment. If you've got a practitioner who's Linghua enough to be able to go, this is a Shanghan thing, I'm going to treat this as Shanghan right now, or, oh, that's Wenbing, I'm going to take it on like that, that as this thing goes on, and I suspect it will go on, I suspect that there's ways that our medicine can be used to be very, very helpful to people. Because if there's not an industrial solution, we might need this more tailor-made solution. I'd like to get your thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, simple thought is, you know, everybody's been talking about the so-called Spanish flu. Well, that's the basis of the seasonal influenza, right? So certain level, it's, you know, don't have pandemics to the degree that we had in 1916 to 1919, whenever that was, but still here, flu still here. And again, this is one of, I think, our failings in the West, is that we haven't really we have not stepped up the way we should have, and now we have no more excuse.
So I'm thinking about the various sort of specialities that we have as Chinese medicine practitioners. There's a fertility group and musculoskeletal, and maybe some people are going to get really good at treating infectious disease. Maybe this is actually an opportunity to advance what we do and to advance our skills.
That'd be great. That's Craig, actually. Craig is he's the Chen Feng, he's the shock troops of the infectious disease, Weigan, Chen Feng, Weigan.
Yeah, I think it must be that Dan has, we've been on talking on this podcast, he's lost his marbles here.
No, but I think it's difficult because for the vast majority of infectious diseases, I would say, you know, probably biomedicine is easier and effective. And so if you want to specialize in that from a East Asian medical perspective, that's going to be a little bit harder. But I think that hopefully as a result of COVID and our response to it, that we will recognize ourselves. I don't think it's really a question of the patients recognizing, but we recognize ourselves that this is something that we have to offer and we need to offer, versus something that we can like, you know, well, that's too much trouble for me, or
go see a functional medicine doctor.
Yeah. So I think this is, again, for me personally, it's a big wake up call that, oh yeah, I've not been doing my job the last decade or two, which is not a very good feeling, but it's very clear. And so we need to step up. Again, more for our medicine and our patients. But I think if we recognize, oh yeah, I can do this, this stuff is something that we're normally quite helpful for, then the patients will follow. We think, oh, that's all, you know, that Weigand, that externally pathogenic stuff, that's not for me, or it's too difficult or whatever, then that's the problem. It's not the patients aren't the problem.
I would just say also in to amplify Dan's comments, I know one of the fortunate things I think that we have had is from the very beginning of this group of patients, Dan and I have worked together on seeing a lot of the patients that we've seen. And I remember early on, we were talking about having real questions about whether we were going to be able to do this over a telehealth platform. I mean, I think both of us we were kind of looking at each other like, really, are we going to actually try and do this just based on the patient's symptom report and looking at the tongue? And half the time, it's like really hard to get a good read on the tongue over Zoom. And do we need them to take a picture of it? And how's that going to work? And the bottom line is, I think at this point that we, and Dan, correct me if you feel differently, but I think we both feel like we have been very helpful to the majority of the people that we've seen. And it's not that we've been able to, you know, make stuff go away in 24 hours or something. I'm not trying to oversell that. But I just, I think I just want to, I guess, in the sense of coming from a positive perspective, I think that we have been positive, pleasantly surprised by how well we've been able to do across these platforms in ways that were not what necessarily what we expected. And so I think that's quite hopeful from that point of view.
Yeah, that's absolutely. And again, I think Craig and Kathy have talked to me about this previously, that, you know, particularly personally, I ended up asking a lot more questions and talking to the people a lot more than I would otherwise. And we've even had some, I would say, some successes in non-acute infections doing telemedicine with herbs that have just made me laugh. I mean, literally laugh out loud, like, we helped that person, like, through Zoom, you know, like, someone with these bad muscle, like, disabling migraines 24/7, they can't sleep, they're all set up, like, really? Like, they're better? Right? And it's like, you know, you can't laugh while you're on the Zoom with the patient, but after they hang up, like, you got to be kidding me. This stuff is much more powerful than we think. And we think it's pretty powerful to begin with. So it's been that's been a lot of fun.
Yeah. You have a funny idea of fun there, Dan Bensky, but I tend to concur.
You're not the first person to tell me that.
All right. Any final thoughts that you guys would like to share before we wind this down? Really, huh?
I don't think so.
Kathy?
No.
Kathy.
Well, I mean, I guess the thing I would say about the study, as you know, as the final thing I would say, is that there has been an outgrowth of this study that I didn't really anticipate that has probably been one of the most exciting things for me, which is when you come together and you do something like this with the community, the level of engagement across our entire community, even nationally, I mean, people who have reached out, we're collaborating with different organizations and individuals. And I mean, I just feel like this is something very, very positive for the herbal medicine community in ways that have yet to be told, but already have shown, I think, relationships that are happening now will grow into something that we'll see 5 years from now, 10 years from now, something crop out of this project in a way that I am sure of and is very, very exciting for me. Keeps me going on it.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for joining me today, all of you. Thank you for the work that you're doing there. All right. So thanks, you guys. The Chinese say huo dao lao, xue dao lao, which roughly translates as continue learning for as long as you live. It's good advice, and when it comes to the practice of medicine, it's essential. Our work gives us an endless opportunity to learn and deepen our understanding, and every challenging and difficult situation brings along some hard work that just might help us to make the world a better place. I hope you've enjoyed today's conversation. Please tune in again next week for a geologically flavored conversation on the curious way the emotions can entangle in ways that prevent us from healing and moving forward in life, and, more importantly, some thoughts on what to do about it. See you next week, friends.